pro-choice liberal feminazi slut Rush Limbaugh warned you about. It's Start Me Up.
Start Me Up.
With Kimberly A. Johnson.
Hello and welcome to my second show. Thanks for listening. I've got a great show today. I've got this wonderful guest. Her name is Soraya Shemily. And we covered all kinds of topics, which I'll go into a minute. But first, I just want to say that I'm so excited because my book, Peyton's Choice, I think it's out today on Amazon, the Kindle edition. I'm not sure about the paperback yet, but I will keep you posted. But just to give you a little background on this, in 2014, at the end of 2014, I had the idea that I wanted to write a book about a teenage girl who chooses to have an abortion. So I had never written a fiction book before. Everything I've written is nonfiction. So this was a little daunting. And once I sat down to start the story, I found that it was really easy and it was really fun. And I took a little bit of, just like any author does, I took a little bit of my own past and spun it out. So the girl in the book is named Peyton. Like me, she's a 6-foot blonde girl who didn't have a lot of attention from boys. And, you know, even though I was attractive when I was younger, it didn't seem to matter. I was always watching my girlfriends have dates and boyfriends while I sat alone home on Saturday night with my mom, or, you know, just not having dates. And so I kind of modeled Peyton after me, but, you know, I never got pregnant, so I never had an abortion, and Peyton does. But anyway, I wanted to write this story about a girl, not just about having an abortion, but you know, what it's like to be going through high school and wanting to be like your friends, and then she finally meets this guy, and he's tall and handsome and he's smart, but he's not perfect, and sometimes actually he can be a jerk. So she has to deal with, you know, him saying certain things to her, and I really tried to put an emphasis on female empowerment. And so, you know, I also, one of the things is I was talking to my mom, who we've done some books together, and you know, we always work together when writing, and she asks me to read her stuff and vice versa. So I told her, I said, I feel a little intimidated because I'm going to write this first time sex scene and it's going to be weird having you read it. Even though my mom and I are really honest and open with each other, it was, you know, awkward. And I also was just in general feeling a little strange about writing it about a teenager having sex. And so the day that I finally sat down to do it, I think it was like a Saturday, and I sat in front of the computer for 8 hours, and it was kind of magical because it just came out. It was like I visualized this movie in my head and it all came out, and my fingers typed it all out. I wasn't thinking, okay, and now they're going to do this. It was just like this natural organic process. And by the end of the day, I was dizzy. I was so tired. And it was fascinating to go through this process. So for anybody out there who is interested, the book is young adult, and it's pretty much gauged or aimed at, it's like 13 to 18 year olds. But since it is, and that's my cat Miranda, by the way, who makes another appearance later on in the show when I'm talking to Soraya. Anyway, so I know that, like, you know, I've always enjoyed watching movies or TV about young people. And so there might be some adults out there, especially adults who are following what's happening in politics and with abortion rights. I tried to cover some of what I've seen on the news in such a way that it's not in your face, but it's just kind of like put in there. And so the abortion actually doesn't happen until kind of toward the end of the story. But, you know, you have all these things that lead up to it, so you can understand why she makes the choice she does. And the questions are, you know, how does she react when she finds out? How does her boyfriend react? Does he want her to have it? Does he try to force her to have an abortion? Does he suggest that they should, you know, stay together and raise the baby? How does her mother react? How does her friends react? So, and what are all the things that go on in her head? Those are the things that I tried to cover and tackle in this book. And so anyway, it's called Peyton's Choice. And like I said, I think right now it is available on Amazon Kindle only. It should be coming out in paperback any day now that you can order off of Amazon. And then eventually it'll go to other online booksellers like Barnes and Noble and all that good stuff. So there's my pitch for my book. So today I did talk to Soraya Shamali, and I'm just going to read her bio right here. She's so impressive. She is a writer and an activist, and her work focuses on the role of gender cultures in politics, region, and media. She's the director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project and an organizer of the Safety and Free Speech Coalition, both of which are involved in curbing online abuse, media and tech diversity, and expanding women's freedom of expression. Her work has appeared in The Verge, The Nation, Time, The Guardian, Huffington Post, The Atlantic, and Rolling Stone. And she, in 2014, she was named one of Elle Magazine's 25 inspiring women to follow on Twitter. She writes and she speaks regularly about gender and media and tech and education and women's rights. And she is just a force. She's so intelligent. And some of the top, mainly we talked about this election. And we specifically focused on Donald Trump and the whole grab him by the pussy comment. She shared her thoughts on, you know, how to talk to men in our culture about rape and sexual assault. And I thought our conversation was really fascinating. And again, my cat Miranda had a few things to say. You might hear her chiming in as well. So anyway, I want to bring her on right now, and we're going to have a really fascinating conversation. And here she comes. Okay, welcome Soraya Shamali. Am I saying your name right, Shamali?
It's Shamali, like an S, sorry.
Okay, welcome Soraya Shamali.
That's right.
Just for the audience, we had an opportunity to meet in the 2012 at the 2012 We Are Woman rally in DC, and we were talking about the war on women then. And ever since then, I've been following you, and you're so impressive, and I'm so happy that you're here and talking with us today. So thanks.
Oh, really and truly, it's mutual. I've been really enjoying seeing what you've been working on and writing, and it was just great to be able to meet you then.
Well, let's just get right into it. And the first thing that I want to tell everyone is, like, let's not get too happy. You know, it looks really good right now from where we're sitting. Hillary's numbers are great, but it's not in the bag. So what do you, you know, what's your general message as far as, you know, it looks good right now, but we don't know what's going to happen. What's your take on this?
I agree with you. It is depressingly closed in my mind. And, you know, every single vote counts. Mm-hmm. And particularly at this stage where we know now that the Senate and the House are at play, you can't really overstate the importance of that. And so I'm not taking anything for granted.
Yeah, I mean, it's really scary. This election is just freaking everybody out, I think. Let me ask you a question about, I'm just going to call it Pussygate, because what else are we going to call it? You know, women are sharing their stories all over the internet. This is something that has, I mean, he called Mexicans rapists. He said so many horrible and deplorable things. Why do you think this grab them by the pussy comment has resonated and has hurt him so much?
I think there are a couple of things. One is that the conversation that was recorded was supposed to be a private conversation, but the tape showed the seamless switch from the kind of really awful conversation that these men were having into their very smarmy faux charm in public. And that did a couple of things. One was it really showed the way the kind of paternalistic, we love women, we respect women, all of the rote lines that men like Trump trot out, mm-hmm. how corrupt it is. Because it showed that really, in essence, at its core, in private, a man that says those things is simultaneously being predatory and exploitative. And I think that that was really dangerous in the minds of the individuals who are leading the party, because it's a direct indictment of the ideas that they embrace. And mm-hmm. and in terms of their own personal identities, there is this trade in complementarian societies and conservative gender relationships between the I'll protect you and you'll give me public power. And if the I'll protect you part is that corrosive at heart, then the power too becomes illegitimate.
Yeah. Well,
I just think.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I just think that these men are shamed and humiliated and angry that they've now been put in this light, when in point of fact, their public policies and the bills that they've been introducing and the laws that they've been passing and the language that they use are not substantively different. I mean, they're not really huge champions of women's dignity or privacy or bodily autonomy, none of that. And they use words that are equally dehumanizing. I mean, just 2 weeks ago during debates for the Hyde Amendment, a man, used a dog metaphor to describe the plight of women of color. So we've heard the pigs and the cows and the dogs and the mules before. Mm-hmm. This is not breaking any molds for the Republican Party, but I think he just put such a bright light on it.
Yeah, and I think that it was the fact that it specifically was triggering. And, adding to that, when on the debate the other night, the way that he was lurking behind her, aside from the stories of women sharing, being sexually assaulted in the manner of what she described on that tape, women are talking all over the internet about watching that debate made them feel physically ill, and it brought up all these feelings of of domestic abusers, or whether it was their fathers or husbands or some kind of male in their life who was physically violent and scary to them. And I think that the fact that this particular video has hit home, it just illustrates that even more, that what he's doing is something that women are experiencing so often. And also there was an article that just recently came out and it was, let me see if I can find it. I think it was What We Can Still Learn from Sexual Harassment. And this was by Anita Hill. And it's just talking about how we focus so much on the men, and we focused on Donald Trump and how this is going to hurt his, candidacy, but nobody's really focusing on the women and the experiences that they're having just watching this guy. And so I think it's an interesting tie-in that, this particular comment has hurt him so much. And I'm kind of interested. I'm kind of chomping at the bit to see what shoe falls next. Have you heard any, is there anything the latest? I know the latest that I've heard is about the 15-year-old girl who's come out and said that Donald Trump, when she was in a beauty contestant, that he came in while she was naked or something. Have you heard anything about that?
I also saw that. He just sort of barged into a changing room during a teen beauty contest. And I think there was nothing new. There's no new information in this tape. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has a long history of talking about women this way, and he is a bottomless pit of reasons to not support him. I think that the response that we're really focused on is the response of these men in power, which was also deeply racist, because they, first of all, imagine if Trump were a black candidate, okay? Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be here today having this conversation. Right. He could never say the things that he said and get away with it. That's one. Mm-hmm. Two, though, was that he specifically threatened married white women. And the response from this cohort of people wasn't to renounce him when he talked about immigrants or Muslims or even just the day before double down on the Central Park Five. He had to be specifically talking about their women, and that's what he did. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that they were genuinely mortified by this. But to go back to what you're saying about this being a triggering event, I'm holding in abeyance any opinions about this being meaningful to men, ultimately, because what I was really struck with was that during the debate, there was in the dead center of the debate, Facebook released trending information that showed that women's number one concern during the debate, the thing that they were talking about the most, were these videos. And then that was followed by ISIS, government ethics, the economy, and then one other item. The tape did not make the top 10 for men. It was not on their radar. And what I find kind of deplorable about that is two things. One is Trump basically stood there and said, it was just words, get over it, sorry if I offended you, now let's move on to more important things. And the men seem to have done that en masse. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't the thing they were talking about. And so I'm deeply troubled by this idea that women are expressing and experiencing a tremendous amount of pain. That's basically what they're talking about. I mean, when the Canadian writer and author, Oxford, when she tweeted out to women, can you share your stories? She expected a few thousand responses, and it's now over 30 million. So women are really saying, hey, this is an issue. It's a political issue. It's an economic issue. It's a social issue. And it's painful and hard, and it impacts our lives. And men are not responding to that with deep empathy or allyship. And that's regardless of race or ethnicity or class. I mean, we're talking about the trending information from millions and millions of people. And that's not to say that there aren't some men that clearly feel this way, but they probably felt this way before too, mm-hmm. right? So it doesn't seem to me that prioritizing other things over this, which is what the men did, indicates a huge change in understanding.
Yeah, and then I think what also emphasizes that is the recent the maps on 538 that show if only women were voting and if only men were voting.
Right. It really puts it into stark relief.
I mean, I think the numbers on that, it is stark, and I'm going to be posting those on my page later, but it's really scary to me. I think with the, what 2016 would look like if just men voted. They've got Trump at 350 electoral votes and Clinton at 188. And then the reverse is what would 2016 look like if just women voted? 458 Clinton electoral votes and Trump with 80. So, I mean, that's really sad. And, you know, something that I mean, I hate to say this because, it's that whole hashtag not all men thing. But whenever I've posted on Facebook about rape or sexual assault, and I kind of phrase it in the vein of, you know, men, please take a look or pay attention. It seems that instead of, you know, there's always going to be those men that come on and say, absolutely right, and we need to pay attention to this. But what I find most of the time is that men get extremely defensive and they act as if I've singled them out specifically, and I'm yelling and shouting at them and calling them sexists and rapists. And I wish we could just get to, my question is, how do you think we can get it to where it's not that we're accusing men of all being such horrible people, but, you know, where's that fine line where we can have a conversation with them without them feeling as if we're accusing them of something?
So I think this is important because I believe that a lot of men's response, again, was one of male centrality, right? It was, don't touch my daughter, my wife, my, mm-hmm. you know, this is horrible. I have a daughter, a wife, a mother. Everybody has a mother. Mm-hmm. Many people have daughters. Lots of people have sisters. That's irrelevant. We're not talking about that relationship or those relationships, right? But then the second place was, don't tar me by association, right?
Yeah.
And that's still not about women. It's more about, this is making me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I think that that's simply a reflection of deep privilege, right? You mm-hmm. You can put this issue aside. You can prioritize other things. And women keep saying, we can't do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this matters. But while women have the power of the vote, the fact is we don't have not really systemic institutional power, right? So what men think and how they respond to this problem is atomized in the law and in media and in corporate culture, because women make up no more than 17 to 20% of leadership of any of those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really important that we get to the heart of this. I think some of it just has to do with the fact that boys never have to learn to cross-gender empathize. And indeed, in large parts of the country are actively encouraged to stop empathizing,
mm-hmm.
particularly with women and girls. And so that's an early childhood education problem, right? It's a problem in parenting. It's something we know exists in the culture. But as far as getting adult men to think, this doesn't have anything to do with me, but I'm still able to empathize and do something about it. And it's just, I don't think it's there. I mean, there is this defensiveness, honestly, because everybody wants to believe they live in a just world and that they aren't privileged, right? And we all have privileges. We have not all of us, but many of us have different forms of privilege, right? Whether it's straight privilege or white mm-hmm. privilege. But in this case, what I'm seeing a lot of is a kind of fallback position of systems justification.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's what it is, because the system is not fair in this way.
No, it isn't. And, it's interesting because on Saturday, I created a post after the whole thing went down on Friday. I was looking at the bill, people weren't really talking about Billy Bush, which, I really didn't know very much about him at all. In fact, I just recently learned that he was a member of the Bush family, President Bush and everything. So I didn't know anything about him other than that he was some guy on Access Hollywood, which I don't really ever watch. So, he apologized and he said that he was embarrassed and it sounded sincere. Whether it was or not really wasn't the point to me. I wanted to make this point on Facebook, and the reason I'm bringing it up is because I did find a fascinating response from both men and women on this. As I said, normally when I bring up something about rape culture, I get a lot of men who are defensive. And in this particular case, I wanted to, the way that I worded it was, Billy, for the sake of argument, let's just say Billy Bush is sincere in his apology. And then I made the case for the fact that there's a lot of men out there who feel pressure to engage in this kind of, talk. Although it's called locker room talk, it's not locker room talk. It's basically engaging in joking about sexual assault. And I've had my own experiences where I've, been like a side thing, and I don't want to forget my main point, was that there was one time I was talking with two fathers, both of them had daughters, and we were talking about rape, and it was just the three of us, and I think they were extremely uncomfortable, and they made a joke about rape. And I didn't say anything. I was insulted, and I was disgusted, but because they were my friends, I didn't, scold them or say anything. And I was pissed and I left and I thought about it and I thought, well, maybe the reason that they made this joke was because they felt awkward and they didn't know what to say to a big mouth feminist and they were just trying to lighten the mood as opposed to really thinking sexual assault is funny. But going back to my post, I figured, well, if we give him the benefit of the doubt and let's just say, he really isn't somebody who thinks sexual assault is funny, but what he was doing was trying to keep his job. And in another case, it would just be like two guys sharing a beer and one of them makes a sexual or joke about sexual assault and the other goes along with it because he doesn't know how to say something he doesn't know how to bring up the fact that it's inappropriate, because then it's a humiliation. You feel uncomfortable doing it. So what I posed this on my Facebook page, and I found that a lot of the men came on and they did empathize, and they could understand it, and they liked the way that I phrased it. Whereas this time women were upset with me and they misunderstood what I was saying as if I was defending Billy Bush, which I was not. I was just trying to say, for the sake of argument, let's just say he felt uncomfortable. So, I mean, I would really love, and, you have such a great mind, and I love the way you see things. And it's just, as you said, it's like this whole systemic thing. I think there's got to be some way that feminists can bring up rape culture. And then, aside from laws and because we're going to have to have better laws, and then that will cause an evolution where, people will get it more than they do. But in the meantime, our conversations online and our conversations with our friends have to somehow, it's walking that fine line of not offending and getting them to go along and say, yeah, we're right there with you. That's a real dilemma for me. Or like a problem that I haven't completely figured out yet.
Yeah, it is a dilemma. And I think, everything has to happen at once. And the ideas we're talking about have life stages, like all ideas, right? And we, all of us individually or as members of certain communities, I think, play different roles in different places. And so personally, when I'm having these conversations, I think a lot about what my standpoint is in a particular space, right? And what the best way to communicate is from that standpoint. In some places, I think a person like you or like me, we're the outlier people. We're the people who are going to push the envelope and say things that are unpleasant for people to have to think about. And that's, frankly, a lot of work, right? Very emotionally taxing to always be that person. But it is important, I think, because it opens the door for other conversations that we won't be part of. And that's okay. Like, it's not a popularity contest to me. I'm like, you know what? I've just gotten to the age where I know these things have to happen, and I have my friends and my family and the people I love and respect, and I don't, I would like people to maybe think about what I'm saying, but they actually aren't going to like me no matter how I say it, because what I have to say is deeply disturbing. And these issues are really hard, and they are not just hard in terms of changing society, but also I think in terms of the way people think of their own identity. I think that one of the issues we have with men is that they grow up hearing that it is their role to protect women and children. And what all these women are saying is, in way, the guys in my life haven't protected me from anything. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you what's been happening to me. And that, I think, brings up feelings of real anxiety and inadequacy in some men, right? Because they think, wait a minute, I've been going along here thinking everything's just hunky-dory and I've been doing my protecting job, right?
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen. Like, when we go out and we walk to school or we walk to work or we're in the subway – or we're on an airplane and some random guy grabs us, which I don't know about you, but I can count the number of times that's happened to me that I can remember. And I've lost track of the other forms of harassment, just the day-to-day stuff. But I think that that's really difficult to process through the lens of how we form our identities, but also how we then perform femininity and masculinity. And I don't think we can discount that, because I think it would be very hard to come to terms with the fact that maybe I haven't been doing that thing that I'm so tied to in my identity.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Hard, but it's interesting, because I think that this effort to diffuse things with a joke, people need to understand that that's not a good idea usually at any point. Like rape jokes, I know people have a super hard time, but we joke about things for. There's a whole canon of interesting sociological work about jokes, and people I think have instincts that are sometimes reflect not the best aspects of their belief systems.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you saw Jacqueline Friedman's article about this issue in The Guardian, but no. She was thinking about this, writing about this just this week, and she got on a plane and the guy she sat next to offered her, no joke, Tic Tacs. And she said no. He said something like, only two or three of them are roofies, so you're probably okay.
Oh, my God.
And so
– That's so awful.
So awful, right? I mean, that's just a bad – not a good joke.
No.
And she didn't respond. I mean, we all know women that have been roofied. Mm-hmm. We just do if we haven't ourselves – experienced that. And so when she wasn't warm and fuzzy, he then turned to, you're not very friendly.
Right. Of course. It always seems to go back to that. You know, I mean, if we're not laughing at their stupid jokes and okay, not all men, hashtag. it seems it's like if they, you know, some men will ask women, you know, hit on women in a bar and, or, you know, texting or whatever it is, and if interest is not shown back, then all of a sudden we're bitches and we're gay or whatever, just some horrible thing, and they turn it around on us as if the rejection is much more than just a simple rejection. It's really sad, and I mean, I hate talking about this because I don't want men who are listening to this to think that I think this of all men, and I feel like I have to say that, you know, every time I make a Facebook post, it's like I have to give the caveat of it's not all men, because inevitably somebody's going to come along and think that that's what I'm talking about. And obviously it isn't, but there's enough out there. You know, and I see the other women who are commenting and trying to explain it. And, you know, some of them are calm and some of them are angry. And it's just sometimes it's just so tiring and exhausting to deal with it day in and day out. Just as you said, it's like, you know, I mean, when you're an outlier and when you're the one who's speaking up, it's mentally draining.
It is mentally draining. And, you know, I also now really have very little patience for that response anymore. I really don't. I'm like, this isn't about you.
Yeah.
Like it isn't about you. And, you know, I go back to the exact, we had a very similar thing happen around Yes, All Women, right?
Yes.
I mean, this was a massive public outpouring of anger and angst, and women are experiencing it at a visceral level in very unexpected ways. I mean, all weekend I had women contact me in private to say, I didn't expect this to happen, but X, right? Mm-hmm. Like I wasn't even thinking about this. I didn't even remember that. It's only when I started thinking, and over and over and over again. And I think the point here, which if I'm feeling not too tired or annoyed. The point here is that, yes, all women live with this toxicity. Every one of us, mm-hmm. from the moment we're born, has to adapt to the threat of male violence and rape. And that is a universal statement. Mm-hmm. We have to do it in different ways, in different contexts, in different communities and societies. But we all have to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of undeniable. And that also doesn't mean, this is the interesting thing about this. Only when you understand that can you truly understand the rapes of boys and children.
Yes.
That's the thing. And when you can switch, when you can switch the conversation to say, hey, this is a function of subjugation, right? This is a function of having lower status, then you can really understand how it is that tens of thousands of boys and girls were raped by Catholic priests, mm-hmm. right? These were men with higher status, with a lot of power, yes. with credibility, with authority, respect, all of these things, and they abused that power, and they were entitled to abuse that power. Same thing with Penn State, same thing with Jimmy Savile at the BBC. And in those cases, nobody says, you know, altar boys dress to be raped or the children in the orphanage lie regularly about being raped. I mean, nobody can apply the same very patriarchal mythologies about rape. And in this country, it's so racialized. Those are inseparable, right? I mean, the racism and the sexism construct each other yes. substantively through the use of rape. So, and that's interesting too for this election because, I think of it as Trump's Border Patrol masculinity, and because he just goes there every time.
Yeah.
I mean, every single time.
Yeah, he does. Which actually, I want to ask you, what do you think? Okay, let's just assume that Hillary is going to be elected because everybody, all the Democrats go out there and vote. What do you think this is going to mean as far as, you know, obviously there's this alt-right, which is really white supremacists and yeah. sexist and bigots. What's the backlash going to be? What do you think? I mean, clearly we saw what happened when Barack Obama was elected and the 8 years to follow. So, you know, since 2012, since I really started to jump into the online feminist community and blogging and opening my big mouth about, you know, all these issues that we've, you know, over the course of 4 years that we've seen from the Republican Party all coming to this huge head right now, what happens when Hillary wins? What do you see happening?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty predictable, especially when we look at other countries, right? Because I think this is a really global phenomenon. I think there's a backlash, clearly. I think that it will get uglier as opposed to getting better. I think that there's a real argument to be made that having a woman president at this point in time is a glass cliff scenario, right? Like, we know that this happens in the corporate world. It happens in the political world, too, which is that when things get really bad and corporations, you know, they're stressed, they're in financial straits that are very difficult, or they're about to face huge market losses, they try and hire people, and the competent men don't even really run for the job, right? Mm-hmm. And because they have other options, but it's an opportunity for women in a way that they don't otherwise have. And the women often take these jobs, and we see this over and over and over again. And it's kind of a shame, really, that this is the way this has played out. But it is arguable that we have a similar political scenario, but in Australia, in Germany, you know, all around the world, we have situations in Brazil where women go into these positions and their tenure is really, really hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I have to say that, I mean, I think Hillary Clinton is probably the best person for that particular job. I mean, you know, I know there's people out there who would prefer maybe Elizabeth Warren being the person, but she's not running. So, and while I would have complete confidence in her, I think that, you know, the history of Hillary Clinton, everything that she's faced up until now, she is the person to handle the misogyny that's going to be thrown her way and our way. As this all unfolds, it's really going to be fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's undeniable that it'll happen. It'll just be kind of awful.
Yeah.
She has had 30 years of practice. I will say that has to stand her in good stead. You know, I don't know that she can ever really prepare for things that are really horribly personally jarring, because she's a human being. Right. We don't really talk about that, right?
Right. Well, she is. She's a human being, and she has feelings. And you know, I mean, I wondered about how she felt at the last debate, because what I saw was a woman who, I mean, she clearly held her own and she looked calm. But I mean, it was just tantamount to abuse, and she, you know, the way that she handled herself was calm, cool, and collected. But what was really going on in her mind, I don't know. She, you know, I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine what it must be like to be her and to have to deal with him.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, he is ultimately his own worst enemy.
Yes.
I mean,
I
know that
he
has this hardcore of supporters, which is staggering, right?
Yeah.
You just think, okay, how is this even humanly possible that this is happening? But it is what it is. But hopefully the Democrats can get enough voters out to make the difference.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, this has been, I could talk to you forever, but I know time is running out. So this has been just a great conversation. You're so smart, and it's so interesting to listen to your points of view. So thank you for taking the time to talk with me, and I hope that at some point you'll come back.
Oh, I will, and thank you. It's always great to talk.
All right, so everybody, please stick around if you're a subscriber for And Another Thing, and Soraya and I are going to continue our conversation, and we're going to take some questions from Facebook followers, and that is only available for subscribers who pledge $5 a month at patreon.com/startmeup. So for all the rest of you, thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon.